From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and we're waiting for the voting to begin in Congress after lawmakers in both parties say they have reached a deal to fund the government and prevent another partial shutdown, which would come on Friday. Congressional Republicans settled for nearly $1.4 billion for physical barriers along the border with Mexico. That's far less than President Trump had demanded. Joining us now is Democratic Congresswoman Deb Haaland of New Mexico. Congresswoman, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
And do you think that the deal that apparently has been worked out is a good compromise?
You know, I trust my colleagues to negotiate in good faith, and I am going to keep an open mind and support what it is that my colleagues have hammered out for us.
What do you think changed this time that allowed the two parties apparently to come together and put some money in for a border barrier, even though they couldn't do it last time, and the government was shut down for 35 days as a result?
Yeah, well, it's the 35-day government shutdown. It was a disaster, and it was a disaster for President Trump because everyone knew that he was the cause of it. People in my district going without a paycheck, being forced to work when they didn't have money to put gas in their car, questioning whether they had health insurance or not with, you know, looming health issues. It was a disaster all the way around. And so we can't go through that again. And I will support legislation to never have another government shutdown again.
Are you concerned at all? Because there was a moment before the last shutdown when it looked like this right now, where the two parties had come together. And then all of a sudden, President Trump backed away and said, I'm not going to support that. Are you concerned that he will do that again this time?
You know, we have such an erratic president. You know, one minute he seems reasonable, the next minute he's off the rails. So, I mean, all we can do is hope that, I guess, you catch him on a good day and he decides to put the American people ahead of his own, warped kind of interests.
Congresswoman, you're one of the few Native members of Congress, and I want to ask you about specifically the shutdown as it relates to Native Americans. There was an address yesterday called the State of Indian Nations Address. It's kind of
yes.
like the State of the Union.
Yes.
And the National Congress of American Indians, President Jefferson Keel, said in that address that the shutdown wreaked financial havoc on Native American tribes. Here he is.
It represented a gross dereliction of duty by our leaders in Washington, who are sworn to uphold the federal government's legally mandated trust and treaty obligations to tribal nations by providing adequate, stable funding for programs that serve our people.
Now, you gave the congressional response to that address yesterday. What did the shutdown mean for Native people, especially given those treaty obligations that he was talking about?
Right. Well, of course, President Keel did not exaggerate the truth at all. It was a dereliction of duty. It is, you know, the federal government is mandated to their treaty and trust obligations to Indian tribes across the country. And it was terrible. Halfway through the shutdown, we had a hearing and invited some folks from Indian country who testified about urban Indian health, about the food distribution program, about services that tribes provide. And they testified that, yes, it was a disaster. Programs were shutting down. They weren't able to serve their communities. And the fact that the U.S. does have a trust responsibility to Indian tribes, they should never be subjected to that kind of inadequacy, which is why that I am co-sponsoring some bills to make sure that tribes don't have to go through this. If there is another government shutdown, these appropriations for health care, for example, need to be exempted.
I want to finally ask you about one more thing that's all over the news today, and that involves one of your fellow freshman Democratic representatives, Congresswoman Ilhan Omar of Minnesota, who has apologized for a tweet suggesting that Republican support of Israel is fueled by donations from AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. What do you think of her initial comments and the backlash against them, including from the House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi?
Sure. Well, I mean, of course, any hint or any type of anti-Semitism in any form needs to be soundly rejected I soundly reject, you know, anyone who puts anything like that forward at all. I thought Leader Pelosi did what she needed to do to make sure that we stop this in its tracks, because the Democrats, we support Israel's right to exist. You know, there are innocent people all over who need to be respected and treated with dignity, and that is something that I will always stand by. So I'm happy that my colleague apologized. I feel like going forward, I'm sure she will learn, and, you know, we're all here to make sure that we are standing by the people.
That is Congresswoman Deb Haaland, a Democrat representing New Mexico's 1st District. Congresswoman, thanks for joining us once again.
Thank you so much. Have a nice day.
Well, to Colorado now, where recreational marijuana has been legal for 5 years. So why has Manitou Springs, a small town in the middle of the state, cornered the market there in El Paso County? Well, it's because its much larger neighbor is the very conservative Colorado Springs, which only allows medical marijuana sales, no recreational. And tomorrow, the Manitou Springs City Council will decide whether to add even more recreational shops. Colorado Public Radio's Dan Boyce explores what that could mean for both cities.
Construction crews are tearing up both sides of the main drag leading into the small tourist town of Manitou Springs.
You know, as you look down Colorado Avenue, you see telephone pole after telephone pole.
That's Ken Jure.
And I'm the mayor of Manitou Springs.
So what the crews are doing is burying those lines to get rid of the poles, make it look nicer. And this project to do that, tax dollars from recreational marijuana sales are definitely helping.
Is there anything do you think wouldn't have started or wouldn't have been possible without that money?
All of it.
The city's Urban Renewal Authority, the fund Manitou uses to pay for these kinds of projects. Before Colorado legalized recreational marijuana sales in 2014, that fund was bringing in $30,000 a year. Now, that number is more than $1 million a year. That is huge for a population under 6,000 people. And it's certainly not only Manitou residents buying the pot to generate that money.
The fact that we have 500,000 people within 4 or 5 miles-ish, and no other competition.
Nearby, the much bigger city of Colorado Springs enacted a ban on recreational marijuana sales in 2013, a year before those types of stores could even open. Manitou Mayor Jure says that's worked out pretty well for his town. The city budget gets all this tax money. The two legal pot shops rake in millions. Kind of a win-win. Well, the loser might be the consumer.
As I understand it, it's quite expensive.
Yeah, we're talking 2 to 4 times the market rate. The Southern Colorado Cannabis Council has been talking with the Manitou City Council to pitch adding more stores. Executive Director Jason Worf says it could bring down those high prices.
And just to even add one more licensee, I think we start to break that up.
To be clear, you can buy marijuana in Colorado Springs. There are about 130 dispensaries in the city. You just need a medical marijuana card to buy from them.
Okay, we have gallon-sized jars here full of medical cannabis.
J.P. Spears runs Trichome Health Consultants in Colorado Springs. Spears has Crohn's disease, which causes inflammation of the intestines. He relies on marijuana himself for pain.
Absolutely.
And he wants his store to take that mantle of being a medical facility seriously. His staff wear scrubs and use medical terminology. Still, he says he really wants to bring in recreational customers, too, because he wants to stay open.
Okay, the state of the business.
He's having trouble making payroll, paying his taxes.
We're desperate each day that comes by to get another dollar in our door.
He doesn't try to conceal his frustration, even his anger, with those two recreational shops in Manitou Springs. He estimates all the medical shops in Colorado Springs combined probably bring in about half of what just those two Manitou stores do every month. That leaves the Colorado Springs store struggling.
They're exhausted. They're burnt out. They're ready to sell. They have nothing left.
He says 2 dozen medical shops in Colorado Springs are on the market to sell right now. Colorado Springs Mayor John Souther says, yeah.
And I expect that will continue. You'll see some consolidation. You'll see the Walmart effect.
So all these Colorado Springs businesses are suffering, and the town is losing out on millions in tax revenue. Why not get in on the game? The city said no when recreational marijuana was legalized more than 5 years ago. The industry has matured a lot since then.
Well, my thought is it is still not culturally a fit, and more importantly, that appears to be the view of the citizens of Colorado Springs.
Souther says recent polling by both pro- and anti-marijuana groups still finds similar disapproval rates for recreational marijuana in Colorado Springs, more than 50% against it. He points to the city's health-conscious reputation as the home of the U.S. Olympic Committee.
And the fact of the matter is the military is very concerned about marijuana accessibility.
Colorado Springs has 5 military bases. And Colorado Springs residents looking to buy recreational pot will continue driving to neighboring Manitou Springs and paying a lot more. They may have more choices in the future, though. The Manitou Springs City Council has started asking for public input on whether to add more recreational marijuana licenses. For Here and Now, I'm Dan Boyce.
As the U.S. fights the remnants of ISIS in Syria, the civilian toll of past battles is still being assessed. ISIS was forced out of the city of Raqqa over a year ago, and NPR has previously reported that hundreds of civilians were killed in an offensive the U.S. military says was necessary to root them out. In this report, NPR's Ruth Sherlock goes deeper, following a human rights investigator who says several of those civilians died on one street in a U.S. artillery barrage. And a warning, there will be graphic and disturbing descriptions of what happened.
In a dirt-poor neighborhood on the outskirts of Raqqa, a little girl in a wheelchair that's far too big for her struggles towards us down a dry mud street. She points to my colleague, Lama Al-Aryan's backpack.
So you're saying, is my backpack an explosive?
No, it's not an explosive.
Poor little girl. It's a sign of what these kids have been through.
These children have been through a lot. This little girl, 10-year-old Fatima, lost a leg during the US-led coalition offensive against ISIS here. We follow her through a gate to her home that's been mostly destroyed by the war.
Assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum.
Fatima's father, Hussein, sits in the ruined house. Like with everyone we speak with here, he feels his situation is too unsafe for us to publish his full name. He tells us his wife and 3 of his daughters were killed in the same attack that injured Fatima on June 10th, 2017. He seems lost and depressed, and he struggles to cope with Amnesty investigator Donatella Rivera's questions. So it's 10-year-old Fatima who fetches the ID cards of her dead mother and siblings for Rivera to document.
Rima Umintani.
Rima Amira.
Amira.
The attack on Fatima's home, Rivera says, was an artillery barrage. And the only people reported to possess artillery during the Raqqa offensive were U.S. forces. Rivera explains.
Artillery was only in the hands of the Americans. There was nobody else, no other coalition partners, no local forces that had artillery. So they were like hitting areas with batteries of artillery shells. Batches of 6, 8, so you would get like maybe 18, 24 shells hitting a whole area.
As we go door to door, Rivera's investigation expands from the deaths in 10-year-old Fatima's family to the story of the entire street called Jama' al-Safa.
Walking into a fourth house.
Everywhere we go, residents show us walls of their homes that have been blown out or ceilings that have caved in on impact. They talk of loved ones or neighbours killed or injured. Rivera confirms some 15 dead and 10 more wounded. Ali, a man in his 30s with these shrapnel scars on his arms, says the day of the attack there were explosions all along the street, all at the same moment. He tells us he tried to rescue the wounded and recover the bodies of the dead. He points to the branches of a nearby tree and gives us a disturbing, gruesome description.
We couldn't find our neighbor Ibrahim or his baby's body. Instead, we found only pieces hanging on this tree. I had to recover their remains from the branches.
Ali lost members of his own family that day, too. He lists the dead for Rivera. His 82-year-old father, Mahmoud, his 41-year-old sister, Rajiha, and her children, 5-year-old Tabarak and Mona, who was just a year and a half old. So what was happening that day? Why would Jamal Safa Street have been a target? In June 2017, local Kurdish forces allied to the US launched a ground invasion against ISIS in Raqqa, supported mostly by American air power. And a unit of Marines was stationed on the outskirts of Raqqa with artillery batteries to assist the Kurdish offensive. At the same time, though, ISIS used civilians as human shields, trapping them in the areas that got bombed. The people on Jamaa al-Safa Street tell Rivera they don't know why their street was targeted. Some said that on that day, ISIS removed a checkpoint at the end of the road, and so many people tried to flee, but the fighting in the city around them proved too intense.
People tried to escape. They were not successful. I don't know, maybe some were, but most of the people came back. And that created a big movement of people.
So whoever was watching from the sky would have seen a big movement of people there and coming back.
Only the people who made the decision can tell us on what basis they made it.
NPR reached out to a coalition spokesperson seeking detailed comment on these allegations. After waiting several weeks, a coalition spokesperson replied by email to say that, due to the subject and nature of NPR's report, they cannot speculate on the turn of events or why US Marines targeted this location. They also said the coalition strikes only valid military objectives after considering the principles of military necessity, humanity, proportionality, and distinction. They say ISIS was killing thousands of people while it held the city, and the US and its allies liberated the town from its brutal rule. But the people on Jamaa al-Safa Street, where children still bring up loose shrapnel to show visitors, say ISIS's brutality still didn't justify the artillery barrages. 23-year-old Ahmed says there had to be other ways to defeat ISIS. He says maybe it would have taken more time, but they could have spared more innocent souls. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News, Raqqa.
Well, all week, NPR is also commemorating last year's Valentine's Day shooting at Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. 17 students and staff slaughtered. And since that terrible day, at least 67 new gun control laws have passed at the state level, three times as many as the year before. At the federal level, there's a new bump stock ban. In the 2018 midterms, gun safety advertising exceeded spending for gun rights ads for the first time. And tomorrow, the democratically controlled House Judiciary Committee will push legislation requiring a background check on all gun sales, even private ones. Allison Anderman is an attorney at the Giffords Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence, the group founded in 1993 after a mass shooting in San Francisco. It then merged in 2016 with former Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords' group, Americans for Responsible Solutions. Allison, Florida, New Jersey, Vermont passed the most laws. What are the top ones?
I think extreme risk protection order laws that enable a family member or a law enforcement officer to petition a court to remove guns from a dangerous loved one.
These are the so-called red flag laws that, as you say, allow a judge to take guns away. We spoke to officers. They're not being as used much by family, but they are being used by officers. And they might have been used by the FBI because the Parkland shooter was on their radar.
That's exactly right. These are life-saving policies that have been proven to be very effective at reducing gun suicide in particular, which is actually the most gun deaths in the United States. Between 2014 and 2017, three states enacted these types of laws, but in 2018, an additional eight states enacted these laws.
What else? We see bump stock restrictions in nine states. Those are being banned. What else?
Yes, and 11 states in 2018 passed laws that keep guns away from domestic abusers, which is a critical step in reducing gun deaths in America, in particular mass shootings, as most mass shootings are actually domestically related.
Yeah. 44 gun laws were enacted by democratically controlled legislatures. 20 gun control laws were enacted by Republican controlled legislatures. Can we call this a shift?
I think so. 14 Republican governors signed gun safety bills last year. Florida, which has been a state typically friendly to the gun lobby, enacted a package of gun safety legislation. When you poll people on specific policies, they're very popular among Republicans and Democrats alike. The divide, as we see it, really happens in legislatures, federal and state.
Well, and some also point to the loosening hold of the NRA. This year, 90% of the state-level bills backed by the NRA were rejected. They have a $38 million debt burden after declining membership. They're facing questions about the NRA's role in possibly funneling Russian money into the Trump campaign. Is it safe to say we're also seeing the NRA still very powerful, but reduced power?
I'm not sure. I think universal background checks really illustrates the power of the NRA at the federal level. 97% of Americans, including 99% of Democrats and 97% of Republicans, not to mention 97% of gun owners, support requiring background checks on all gun sales. Yet, even after the slaughter of 20 first graders at Sandy Hook Elementary in 2012, we were unable to pass this most basic of gun safety laws. Yeah. And even now, it's remarkable that the House has had its first gun violence prevention hearing in about a decade, but still there are tremendous hurdles at the federal level to enacting even universal background checks.
That's Allison Anderman, attorney at the Giffords Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence. Allison, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And there were states that loosened gun restrictions. Two passed Stand Your Ground laws, two allowed guns in schools and places of worship, but six states passed concealed carry restrictions, three raised age requirements for sales. Your thoughts on more gun control, welcome hereandnow.org.
Here and Now is supported by LegalZoom, who wants you to know that if you want to make 2019 the year you finally start a business or secure your family's future, LegalZoom can help. With their network of independent attorneys licensed in all 50 states, LegalZoom can help you navigate your legal needs from wills and trusts to LLCs, trademarks, contract reviews, and more. And the best part is, LegalZoom is not a law firm, so they don't charge by the hour. More at LegalZoom.com/now.
And if you're sitting in traffic right now, you probably won't be surprised to hear that Americans lose around 100 hours a year on average because of traffic congestion. The traffic data company INRIX released a study today that shows that comes out to around $1,300 per person per year. INRIX also ranked the cities with the worst congestion. Boston and Washington, D.C. took the top honors, followed by Chicago and Seattle. Ali Velshi is MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent and co-host of Velshi and Rule. Hi, Ali.
Hey, Jeremy.
So when we talk about traffic congestion costing us money, this is not just about gas.
No, it's a number of things. For instance, it's wasted time. It's time that you're not otherwise earning. It's carbon output into the environment, overpayments, things that are tied to the extra time you spend there versus the time you would have spent or the money you would have spent if you got to work without or got where you were going without congestion.
Does it surprise you that Boston averaged 164 hours a year in traffic, Washington, D.C., 155 hours are above a place like Los Angeles.
Like Los Angeles, right? And it's kind of interesting when you think about it. When you look at the world rankings, Boston is the only city to make it into the top 10 of the world's most congested places. There are a couple things to this. One is it's a size, right? LA is notorious for its congestion and its crawl, but it's bigger, so it's spread out over a bigger area. Boston doesn't get bigger. I mean, it's an increasing number of cars in a smaller place. Washington, Philadelphia, they all have these similar problems in that there are more cars, including because of ride sharing services, and the infrastructure is not getting bigger, so it's getting worse. In fact, Boston's a net improvement over last year, but it's still more serious than any other American city.
Why haven't cities in this country taken more to congestion pricing? This is something that London has done, where you charge cars to come into the center of the city during peak times.
You know, it's harder in America than it is elsewhere, largely because of our ideological opposition to government, to taxing, and to the fact that we, you know, seem to be the home of ideological home of driving. So there are a lot of reasons why they struggle with it. New York has just started implementing some version of it, which is meant to improve public transit and discourage people driving cars. But it's harder. Now, the argument in favor of it is simple. Look at a place like New York, where almost everybody pays to get into Manhattan.
Right.
But people don't pay to go from uptown to downtown or things like that. London has solved that. It's something cities are going to have to reconsider, even if historically they've decided against it.
Well, and I think there's one bridge that you can come into Manhattan.
That's right.
Without
That's why I said almost everyone. Yeah.
Exactly. So what about, okay, forget about taxing people. What about public transit? I mean, if we're spending so much money and so much time every year sitting in traffic, at what point does America say, okay, let's invest in fast trains to get us around?
Right, which again, if you look around the rest of the world, they're doing some version of it. Trains are obviously difficult in well-established American cities because it's hard to, you know, we use what's called a cut-and-cover method, so you have to close streets down like they did on Second Avenue in New York for years. Mm-hmm. But, you know, a lot of countries are going to dedicated lanes and light rapid transit and things like that. Again, it's something to think about. It becomes harder in the Boston, Philadelphia, New York area where the infrastructure is all completely crowded in. But for newer cities, or cities that still have that space, they're thinking about it. It's actually one of the reasons LA's done a little bit better, because they actually built a public transit system that some people are using, and it's growing the downtown core.
Subway to the sea.
Yep.
Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Drummer Antonio Sanchez's new album reflects a longtime passion for people on the move, something he knows a bit about. Antonio emigrated to the U.S. from his native Mexico City to study music at Boston's Berklee College of Music in 1994. He's since been welcomed with open arms and accolades. A longtime member of the Pat Metheny Group, he composed the score for Birdman. His 2017 album, Bad Hombre, was nominated for a Grammy. He's become a U.S. citizen. And his new album is dedicated to fellow immigrants who didn't come to pursue a passion, but to flee in fear. His album with his group Migration is titled Lines in the Sand. It begins with spoken word.
Do you have a warrant? Are you with ICE?
The introduction to Travesía from Antonio Sanchez's new album Lines in the Sand. And he joins us from the NPR studios in New York with more. Antonio, good to talk to you again.
Good to speak to you again, Robin. How are you doing?
I'm good. And what are we hearing there?
Well, that's a collage that I put together of different people being stopped by the immigration police. Most of these people were actually U.S. citizens, so it was pretty obvious to me that they were being stopped on the basis of racial profiling. What I'm trying to do is for people to reflect just for a second on how hard some people have it.
You are very clear here in some more music that we're going to listen to how much you feel like a lucky immigrant, and we should recognize those who aren't as lucky. But I'm wondering if, along with your anger about some of the things you're seeing and hearing, do you also feel maybe guilty?
That's a good question. It wasn't easy for me to come to the States. It's easy compared to those people, but I mean, my immigration situation, as it is for most Mexicans, is pretty convoluted. I had to renew my visas every 6 months sometimes. If I was in the middle of a tour in the summer, I would have to go back straight to Mexico and renew my papers. I got harassed innumerable times whenever I would come into the country. Now that I have an American passport, all of that miraculously went away. Mm. So being a Mexican citizen and an American citizen, I'm just really aware of what's going on with both of our countries right now.
Let's listen to some of the poetry that you've incorporated in your music to express some of these thoughts. Again, the CD is Lines in the Sand. There's a piece Lines in the Sand, Part 1 and Part 2. Let's listen. This is At the Wall / U.S.-Mexican Border, Texas 2020, written and read by Paola Gonzalez and Carly Gutierrez.
Faceless crosses erased from its gleaming surface,
replaced with hues of red, white, and blue.
55 feet of cold concrete that runs from the Pacific to the Gulf,
and a cheer from those who used to cross.
Joyous, relieved, grateful, and a silenced cry from those who used to walk,
hoping their water and prayers will last.
Tell us your dishonored names, and we will tell. Listen.
Tell us more about that poem and what it meant to you.
One day, while I was writing the music for the album, I had this section that I really liked, but I always felt like it needed something else, something a little bit more dramatic to give it a push. And I started just looking on the online, basically on YouTube. And one of the things I ran into was this poem by Carla and Paola. And I put it on top of that section that I was working on, and, you know, I got chills. It just spoke to me. You know, it's very graphic how people are, you know, literally walking through the desert, hoping their prayers and water will last.
You know, Antonio, we know the facts about the border, that actually illegal immigration has really plummeted. It's largely women and children now. And that illegal drugs crossing the border are usually coming through legal entry points. And yet, you know, there's a perception of what's happening at the border. And more than that, there is a reality for many Americans along the border where there are problems, where they're feeling overwhelmed, their resources are overwhelmed. We've also spoken to people on this program. One mother whose son was killed by an undocumented immigrant who'd been in and out of the country several times.
It's such a convoluted subject. Of course, if immigrants come into the country legally or illegally and they commit crimes, you know, of course they should be deported. And it's like, for example, whenever there's a terrorist attack and Muslim people find out that the person who perpetrated the attack is Muslim, I'm sure they roll their eyes and they go like, oh, no, please, not again. Every time I see like a crime was committed by a Mexican that was illegally in the country, I also roll my eyes. I'm like, you know, dude, please, you know, don't. it's just, you know, very obvious that certain things are going to perpetuate the stigma. But, you know, it's not the majority of the people.
Overall, it sounds like you just want people to, as you say, be aware of people on their journey, all different kinds of journeys. And that brings us to the song that you wrote the music for. Your wife, Tana Alexa, a beautiful and talented singer in her own right, wrote the lyrics. And it's funny, she has kind of a reverse immigration story from you. She's Croatian-American, brought up here, you know, all-American girl. And then her parents, if I've got this right, moved her back to Croatia when she was 13?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then she moved back.
And then she moved back again. Yeah. Let's listen to a little of the song you did together, Home.
Where is home?
Tell us more about that part of this. Those who look at an immigrant as an alien, that person, their heart also usually beats for home.
Yeah, I mean, it's a complicated existence because I don't feel 100% American, of course. I do feel 100% Mexican, but I've been away for more than half of my life. And for Tana, it's the same thing. You know, she doesn't feel 100% American. She doesn't feel 100% Croatian. And you kind of try to make home wherever it is that you are at that moment. And we travel so much that also that makes it even harder to feel grounded. Luckily, the music, the art that happens in New York and all of our friends, they make us feel that ground that we need sometimes.
Longing heart, when apart.
You I was just thinking, the movie Green Book is so big now. The story of Don Shirley, the African-American pianist, extraordinary musician, but he needed a bodyguard to travel through the South. And there was that conflict of audiences just adoring him and applauding him, and then he couldn't go to the restaurant. I'm wondering if you ever have a touch of that when you're traveling, you know, adulation, you know, when you play. And yet maybe somewhere in your mind you're thinking, but I'm an immigrant.
Yeah, I mean, it's it's always an interesting thing to experience because, for example, Southern hospitality is not a myth. I mean, people are incredibly nice. But then I wonder, okay, if I actually moved to Kentucky or to Memphis and I moved right next door to some of these people, how would they react? I've had good friends that live in southern states, and they've had interesting experiences because they don't look like they're from there. Mm. And sooner or later, you know, there's little things that happen that hint towards, okay, you definitely are different and we see you, you know.
Well, with that in mind, Antonio, is there a song you'd like us to go out on?
One thing that would be nice to include, if possible, is the very last poem, because I think is so beautiful.
Jonathan Mendoza?
Yeah, and it's like an alternative pledge of allegiance, seen from the point of view of an immigrant.
I pledge allegiance to my abuelo, to the calluses on his Sierra Mountain hands, to the guitar he'd haul through the desert, strapped to his back like a weapon. I pledge allegiance to the music we make from our survival, to my immigrant parents, to my immigrant grandparents, to my immigrant great-grandparents, to the ones who brought us here, to the dreams they shoved inside their pockets like breadcrumbs and loose lint.
That's the composer, drummer Antonio Sanchez, his latest album with his band Migration, Lines in the Sand. Antonio, thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Of course. Thank you, Robin, as always.
To home, and to the naming of it, to the first indigenous child to call this something other than a white man's land, to the first town.
Employees of the video game company Activision Blizzard are bracing for job cuts after low sales figures sent the company's stock tumbling last week. The video game companies Take-Two and Electronic Arts have also struggled with ups and downs in recent months as they face growing competition from free-to-play games like Fortnite that are popular with users of the streaming service Twitch. Let's take a look at the gaming industry now with our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Kurt Wagner is senior editor for Recode. He joins us from San Francisco. Hi, Kurt.
Hi, Jeremy.
And I just said a lot of words that I don't know what they mean. So we're delving into a world that I'm not that familiar with, which is the video game world. But first of all, let me ask you, how does the rise of Twitch and other video game streaming services factor into the size of the industry right now?
Well, I think the video game industry has been a massive industry for a long time. I think in 2018, it was around $140 billion globally. And a lot of these streaming services are still very new. So they're not necessarily contributing a ton to the larger monetary value. But what they are doing is they're kind of turning video games into this, you know, spectator sport, if you will. So instead of video games being something that someone does on their own or even with just a small group of people in their home, you know, you're now able to watch other people playing games. You're able to play with other people over the internet. And it has really become, a community type thing that I don't think it necessarily had, at least at this scale before.
So what's on the screen when you watch a Twitch stream?
Yeah, so Twitch in particular has about three elements to each broadcast. So there's that main screen that you're watching, which is usually, you know, watching someone else play a video game. And so it's as if you're standing there looking over their shoulder at the same screen that they're looking at. So that's part one. Part two is usually a camera that's focused on the person who's actually playing the game themselves. You can see their face. They can talk to the camera. You can kind of almost, they can narrate what they're doing while you're watching. And then the third element is this kind of group chat thing. So there's, in theory, thousands, if not more, people watching this person play video games at the same time. You can comment. You can interact. It's kind of got a community feel to it.
Well, and that brings us to a way that Twitch got into the news recently, which has to do with charity fundraising. This is what happened last month when the British YouTube star H Bomber Guy streamed himself playing Donkey Kong 64. He'd been playing for 50 hours straight to raise money for the charity Mermaids UK, which supports transgender youth, when a high-profile viewer called in. Let's listen.
Already did that part. What's this?
Oh, there we go.
There we go.
Hello?
What's up?
Would you like to introduce yourself? I'm sure chat is going wild. They know who you are, but
I want it on the record. I need to know.
Of course, everyone. My name is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I am the congresswoman for New York's 14th Congressional District.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Okay, so she called in, and then they raised a ton of money because of this.
Yeah, this kind of thing is happening. There are the ability for streamers, people who are broadcasting, to basically make a living themselves. So if I'm a viewer of a stream and I really like the person who I'm tuning into, I can, you know, donate basically to them. And some of them, as you just showed, have turned that ability into actually raising money for a charity. And so there is money exchanging hands sometimes on a lot of these streams. Sometimes it's to, you know, line the pockets of the person who is creating the content, and sometimes it's for a bigger cause.
Why are these games so popular, these streaming games, as opposed to people playing games on their own?
Well, these are just regular games. They're not necessarily special games just meant for streaming, but they are games that are popular to watch live, typically because there's a whole bunch of people playing. So instead of, you know, just maybe watching one person play a narrative game, you're watching hundreds of people play together at the same time. So I do think that, you know, this kind of what is called massive multiplayer game has, you know, just created, again, I keep saying this word community. It sounds a little cheesy, but I think it really is true. It's given people the ability to do something they love, which is play video games, but do it with a lot more people.
And we saw there that it's having an impact on charitable causes, but also think about all the other ways that this could change gaming and other industries. The head of the NBA has said he wants to make sports look more like Twitch. The NFL already streams Thursday night games on Twitch. Is sports the next frontier? Kurt, do you think for Twitch?
I think what sports offers is another type of content that's really good live, right? It's not really fun to watch a game once you already know the result. So you kind of have to tune in while it's going on. And so I think that there's that live element for sports. But what we've seen with Twitch and others, you know, YouTube, Facebook, there's really this drive to have any type of good video content where there are people actually watching together in real time, commenting back and forth, having an interaction. So anything that a tech company can do to kind of bring people together in one place at the same time, whether it's gaming or something else, I think they're going to try and do it.
And by the way, I've been saying Twitch, I guess we should say Amazon bought Twitch for $1 billion in 2014. Yes. So it's really Amazon.
Amazon owned Twitch. Let's say that.
Okay. That is Kurt Wagner, senior editor at Recode. Kurt, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.